This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Radio Haiti was a service that developed a deep connection with the Haitian people. It was revered in part because it reported news and cultural affairs in the Haitian Creole language spoken by most Haitians.
Li commencé depuis que gen invasion du riz nan vallée la Tibonite. Du riz sorti Miami, sorti nan pays étranger, y a rentré en Haïti.
That was the voice of a Haitian rice farmer talking about how U.S. subsidies were destroying his livelihood. It is just one of the many voices recorded by Radio Haiti, the first independent Haitian radio station. Radio Haiti spent decades covering the social, cultural, and political stories often ignored by most other Haitian media. The station was shut down a number of times by the government and was under constant government pressure while it was on the air. It closed for good in 2003. But thousands of tapes from the station still remain. And last year, the co-director of the station donated the entire collection of tapes to Duke University. Staff members have been processing and digitizing the tapes. Some of them are now available at a new website. We are joined by two Duke staff members to tell us more about the story. Laura Wagner is an anthropologist and a writer who's been working on the project for the past year. Welcome, Laura. Good to talk with you.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Laurent Dubois. He's a professor of romance studies and history and the founder of the Forum for Scholars and Publics at Duke. Welcome back, Laurent. Good to have you.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about the backstory. Before we get into how you got the collection, just a little bit more about Radio Haiti and its importance.
Well, this station really was, as you described, a kind of a station where people's, where Haitian voices were heard, where Haitian voices across the spectrum from rural areas and urban areas were heard, where many of Haiti's great thinkers were interviewed. It's a radio station that people who lived through that period remember well. They remember the sound of it. They remember certain parts of it. And just kind of as an archive speaks to a whole kind of dramatic history of this country over the past several decades. It's really an unparalleled archive for that.
And so tell us what's in it. What has been preserved? What was saved?
Well, all of their programming, remarkably, was saved in these tapes. So these include opinion pieces, interviews, news from the streets, news of you know, sort of news right at the time of certain political events. And again, things like what we just heard earlier, voices from different participants. And really, in a sense, the kind of station embodied a kind of democratic impulse in the sense that all these voices could be heard and presented on the air.
And put in perspective and in context as well. So Laura, if you can give us a sense of the scope, how many tapes, how many hours are we talking about?
I think it's more than 3,000 tapes and maybe something like 4,600 hours approximately. We don't know exactly how many hours there are, but it's a huge wealth of voices, of information, of real-time information and voices, because a lot of, I think, what people have heard about these moments in time, these eras, is all hearsay now for people who are relatively young. Or people even who lived through them but who don't have that kind of record. And so it's remarkable to have it recorded as a sort of real-time document.
You've got the voices of the people on the street as they're experiencing these events, scholars as well, and newsmakers all embodied in these tapes. Well, at the center of Radio Haiti and this story is a journalist named Michelle Montaz. She and her husband, Jean-Dominique, took over the station in the late 1960s and ran it through three tumultuous decades. Jean was assassinated by hired gunmen in 2000, and Michelle closed the station and left Haiti 3 years later after an attempt on her own life. Michelle currently lives in New York, where she continues her work on human rights issues in Haiti, and she joins us from a studio in New York now. Michelle Montaz, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you, Frank.
Tell us more about the founding of Radio Haiti, what you and Jean-Dominique had in mind when you took over the station, and I gather changed its point of view a little bit.
Well, I have to say that Jean started before I did. Went back to Haiti after studying in the States and going to journalism school, and when I got there, Radio Haiti was already on the air. And it was owned by Jean-Dominique, who had bought it from the previous owner. And he was slowly transforming what used to be an entertainment media, like all radio stations in Haiti, into a new station. It started first with cultural issues. It continued with more social issues. And we went into news and news in Creole. I joined the station in 1973, and I started with the newsroom. And it was an extremely interesting adventure, you know. It was about, for the first time, doing news in a language that the majority of Haitians could understand. And doing news, period, because we were under a dictatorship, there was no such thing as news. What was in the media in general, whether it was the written press or the broadcast media, was essentially special official statements by the government, by the dictatorship, and by ministers and by officials from here or there. And there was no such thing as reporting. So in a way, what we started in the early 70s bloomed into something much richer as we went on. We started with cultural issues because that's all we could talk about. And we have a number of interviews in the archives which are of you know, Haitian writers and different cultural interviews. And what was interesting also at the time is that Jean-Dominique tried to also talk to people who were making the news in a cultural field, but were not part of the mainstream. I'm talking about people whose art was rooted in voodoo. I'm talking about people who lived in the countryside, were doing art away from Port-au-Prince. And even the cultural news touched one segment of Haitian population that was never touched before. And we went on until we actually went further into political subject. At that time, everything was political. Right. You talked about the garbage in the streets, and that was political. So slowly we evolved into, you know, a truly news station. Of course, under a dictatorship until 1980, under that dictatorship, we had to be extremely careful about what we could say.
Well, maybe I'll ask you to describe that dictatorship, because it's shocking in a way when you understand the absolute control that that dictatorship had over the political life in Haiti, how you were allowed to operate at all. But describe for us the political milieu, the dictatorship in which you operated.
Well, after François Duvalier, the father, died, the son tried to open up a little bit. So he wanted to appear democratic so as to attract for an aid, essentially U.S. aid. And so there was some, let's say, cosmetic changes made. And suddenly, you know, people could interview different. We had absolutely no problem extending our work, you know, to news that were never spoken of before. However, there were still a lot of taboo subjects until the Carter administration came in the late 70s and opened up a window by simply telling Jean-Claude Duvalier, listen, it's either there is no violation of human rights or there is aid. I mean, you cannot violate human rights and receive aid. So at that time, there were a number of gestures that allowed us to just crack open a window that was open really by the international context. And of course, at the beginning, we could only, for instance, talk about political issues through proxy. For instance, we covered the fall of Somoza. Just not being able to talk about the political situation in Haiti, we talked about Somoza, the fall of Somoza. We sent a reporter in Managua to cover actually what was happening to Somoza. And when it was translated into Creole, it was translated as, it was given a nickname as Round Jaw, Mashwe Won. Round Jaw in Creole could also apply to Jean-Claude Duvalier, who was quite chubby. And, you know, a lot of people were listening to international news because that was a way for them to know about what it meant to have a revolution, what it meant to actually overpower, you know, the forces that were there in Nicaragua. So it's to tell you that it was a slow process that took 5-6 years until 1980. Then, you know, again, to show that he was being democratic, Duvalier, Jean-Claude Duvalier, had allowed, for instance, for labor union to start working again. The father, François Duvalier, had closed every single and destroyed and arrested every single member of unions, whether they be student unions, unions working in factories, whether any, there were no unions allowed to exist. So he started opening, allowing, you know, labor unions to open again. And, you know, labor activists started actually going to factories and recruiting members. And we still had to be extremely careful.
I was going to say, were you able to cover this? Were you able to reflect this in the news, or did it just happen without a lot of notice?
Well, frankly, they would come to one labor activist would come to me and says, "Michel, I have seven labor unions that were formed today in seven different factories," and I would say, "I'm sorry, you know, I can only talk about three." Well, and the next day, I would talk about the three other ones or the four other ones. But, you know, it was a progressive. We had to go slowly. But sometimes events took over, you know, as they have a way to do in journalism. For instance, we covered the presence of Haitian boat people who had fled Haiti and were stranded in an island called Cayo Lobos. And we covered very extensively what was happening there. And it was a shame for the government. And I think we rattled quite a few people, which explained why we were really crushed in 1980.
We are talking with journalist and human rights advocate Michel Montaz, Haiti scholar Laurent Dubois, and anthropologist Laura Wagner, talking about Radio Haiti today on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, today talking about Radio Haiti, the first independent Haitian radio station. It was on the air throughout much of the political turmoil of the late 20th century, and it resisted political repression. It told true stories of Haitian people, culture, and politics. Duke University is now home to the Radio Haiti Archive, and we are joined today by three guests who will talk about it. Laurent Dubois is a professor of Romance Studies and History and the founder of the Forum for Scholars and Publics at Duke. Laura Wagner is an anthropologist and a writer who's been working on the project for the past year. And Michel Montaz is a former station co-anchor who now lives in New York. And Michel, before the break, we were talking about the ingenious ways in which you had to tell the news, talk in code, use the Creole language to use code words that could make one story stand for another, and carefully parse out how you were going to get the news out. Was this a constant challenge? Were there meetings every day about sort of how to tell the news without offending the authorities?
Well, at the time, before 1980, yes, there were of course subjects that were taboo. I mean, for the sake of you know, my journalist safety, I could not send anyone on anything touching drugs, for instance, which actually happened also after Duvalier was overthrown. You know, covering drugs was when the army was in power was also too difficult and too dangerous, too risky for our journalists. So
this is because I assume. Forgive me for interrupting. I assume this is because the army and the government were involved in the drug trade. Am I right?
Yes.
Yeah.
You have guessed right.
Yeah. But go on.
And it was extremely. So there were subjects that were always, and we were very careful at the time. But you know what really made a difference between what we had to go through between 1976, 73, let's say, and 1980, when we had really they decided to destroy Radio Haiti. And we were on November 28, 1980, we were they came to the station, the military police, they arrested everyone on site. And the station was completely destroyed. All our studios were destroyed in a very brutal way, and all journalists were arrested. And we were taken to the political prison in Port-au-Prince. And at that time, we knew from 1976 and 73 until 1980 that we were facing one enemy, which was the regime. After 1986, when we came back from our first exile, because we had been exiled. Both my husband and I lived in New York during that exile. When we came back in 1986, there was, of course, exhilaration in the street. People were, happy about being able to speak out freely, you know, because the army then was in power and was forced to appear democratic. And at that time, the danger was still there for us journalists. It was even more dangerous to the extent that, of course, we no longer faced the state as is, but we faced a number of militias that were left over from the former regime. We faced a number of, let's say, independent operators, and we were constantly also in danger. Even though we were speaking freely, but we knew also at the time that it was always risky business.
And just to give us a sense of how popular you were and how much you meant to the Haitian people, I think there are a couple of stories of natural disasters in which people would come from all over Haiti to the radio station because you were the source of information and had become, in some ways, and do I have this right? I mean, in some ways, you were the government. You were the voice of the people.
Well, that's why. They just didn't trust that they could be helped by the government. This happened under Duvalier. It also happened after that, you know, when there were crises, you know, natural disasters, hurricanes. People would come, or floods in the Artibonite Valley. People would come to us. And I found myself as a journalist, you know, holding a baby at 11 o'clock at night, and our whole reception area turned into a makeshift,
a home and a community
people.
Center.
Yes.
Well, I can understand. And I think this gets to something else. You talked about the danger in reporting on directly on any political issues, and those political issues included all of the stories, economic and otherwise, that had privileged the privileged class. But even, it seems to me, in reporting on cultural issues, there is something subversive about it, and you just proved it. If you speak in the language of the people, you undermine one of the projects of the privileged class, of the dictatorship, which is to show people that you aren't good enough. You don't speak the right language. You depend on us. What you have isn't enough. And so it seems to me that by reporting on the culture of the people and reflecting it back to them, that's subversive and dangerous to a dictatorial regime that represents so few people.
It certainly was. It certainly was when we covered, for instance, regular voodoo ceremonies, and we reported on them. It was unheard of. You just didn't talk about voodoo in Haitian media. It just didn't exist, even though it is the religion of the majority of people. You just did not talk about it. And talking about it freely, showing that, the recourse to showing that it was a religion, a very elaborate religion, and, talking to not only scholars about the religion, but about practitioners of the religion, about the differences between, what we call the right hand and the left hand, which is good voodoo and bad voodoo, you know. And this type of thing were never aired before. And the fact that we talked about it really, I think, made a difference in making people feel like they owned us, they owned their own identity, and being Haitian meant something different.
So, Laurent Dubois, it is clear why this radio station was important to the people of Haiti. Now we have the tapes and a vast record of what this station did. Why is that important to the rest of the world? Why is that important to us?
Well, I think this record of the station, right, which we've now tried to kind of put back on the air in a sense by making the recordings available over the website, just give us a whole sense and an ability to think about this history in a very different way. And I think the effects of that history on contemporary Haiti, also on the United States, which was deeply implicated, are enormous. I would say just as it was really valuable for this to be on the air in Creole, the fact that this is an archive in Creole is also incredibly valuable. It's an audio archive that most Haitians can access if they can listen to it. It's in their language. And so in that sense, we think it's a really valuable record going forward for people to understand the past and its relationship to the present and
future.
You
talked about the American involvement, too. There's a series on the Rice Wars, for instance, mm-hmm. in which the United States is very deeply involved, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot in there that's really also about the U.S., which, of course, has played such a fundamental role there. So, of course, most of the recordings are in Creole, and so, but we've created a guide that's both in English and Creole for people to learn from the recordings, which is what Laura's been working on.
Well, Laura, tell us about that and your involvement.
Yeah, I've been working in Haiti since 2008. I started learning Haitian Creole in 2004. And what I do is I listen to the tapes once they're digitized. So the people in the library and on the tech end of things have done just a really beautiful job digitizing these recordings. And they're so clear and they're so gorgeous. And especially for people in Haiti, for people who, you know, when they listen to these recordings the first time, you know, it was on the radio. People's radios may not have been that great. Things were staticky. So when people listen to it now, they are overwhelmed with how clear it is and how alive everyone sounds. And so I'm just the really lucky person who gets to listen to them once they're digitized and then write about what's in them and write the descriptions in English and in Creole and
get them out on the web.
Get them out on the web.
Well, Michelle, just to say that. Yeah. So far they've digitized just a tiny portion of this vast archive. It's a massive undertaking going on in the library. So we just have a very few beginnings, but it's even what we have is just the very beginning. So.
Well, ordinarily, I would guess you would try to get all this stuff all done and release them all at once. But I gather that the importance of these tapes has persuaded you that you should get them out in batches, huh?
Well, I think Michelle and really had a sense that this is information people need now. You know, it affects how people think about Haiti today. So this is not an archive just for a far future or for scholars, but one that's really kind of a living archive. And we wanted to give it to people as quickly as we could and
as much as possible. That would be if I could have a right superpower. It would be to get it
if
all
I
done
can add something. If I can add something to what Lauren was just saying, is that the stories are relevant today. Haiti is in the middle of a pre-electoral crisis again. This is very similar to so many crises we have covered. Amazingly enough, the actors are still the same. They are the same people. The problems and the issues are still the same. The price of gasoline, you know, people demonstrating in the streets, students facing MINUSTA, the UN troops, and all these we had covered before.
Maybe as an object lesson, you could take us back to the Rice Wars. We've made a couple of references to it, and I think that's one that, again, surfaces today, particularly in advance of these elections. Tell us about covering the Rice Wars initially and what that was about and why it's still relevant today in some ways.
Well, the Rice Wars, actually, there were several wars. The one we covered first was in the Artibonite Valley when the military government came into power, and the military government, after the fall of Duvalier, opened the ports that François Duvalier had closed, leaving only one port open, Port-au-Prince. Now, the new government opened the ports, and the ports of Gonaï started receiving rice that had been subsidized in the U.S. and selling them at prices that were much lower than the peasant could afford, the rice growers could afford to have to practice, because essentially those prices did not take into account price of entrance, the price of just actually growing that rice. And when the rice came from the U.S., it was actually rice from Arkansas, as I told Mr. Clinton when I met him on this issue. The rice came in, and because of the IMF, International Monetary Fund, dictate to a number of countries like ours, we were in a situation where there were no tariff on that rice coming in. So first, it was subsidized. Second, they didn't have to pay taxes. Mm-hmm. So all that rice would pour into Gonaïve, which is a port in the Artibonite area. So there was that first upheaval in Gonaïve, which is on our website right now, and then there were other wars that came way after that in the 90s, the same war about the same issue. And right now, the production of rice in the Artibonite Valley, after so many years of those different rice wars, right now a lot of the peasants in the Artibonite are telling you that they no longer want to plant rice because the price is too high.
Well, so this leads to the question, and I think, Lorraine, this is why it's important to get it out there. But, yeah, this is American rice that is subsidized, At the same time, we see neoliberal reforms taking away the protections that had created some semblance of order in Haiti. All this happens, and then what we see, what gets reflected in the American press, is any kind of disruption or disorder, which makes it look like a disordered place in political chaos, without properly understanding the role of the United States government and international economic policies that have caused all of this. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's, to me, one of the most important roles that you can play for the rest of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Haiti kind of cycles into the news in the United States, kind of appears, and people look at things without much context often. So this can help to provide at least a place for understanding the long-term effects. And obviously, issues around poverty, food production, political questions, all of these are long, old stories that, you know, we need to understand what's going on.
Michelle, how important are these tapes now that they're available again to the larger Haitian diaspora?
I think they are very important for a lot of reasons. Because what we tried to do during the time we were broadcasting was to usually place the news in a context. We usually went beyond the event, which is not happening right now in the Haitian press, in the Haitian media. We went beyond the event, and we had a number of, for instance, interviews and roundtable discussions around issues. And this is that part of the archives which I think is really essential. It brings into perspective a number of events, because events repeat themselves, circumstances sometimes change, but the basic root of the problem remains the same. And I think it's important that because we did try to have a wider view of what was happening. And the fact also that we did try to go to a segment of the population that was never covered. We gave a lot of emphasis to the coverage of what was happening in the countryside. You know, in Haiti, there is the Republic of Port-au-Prince and there is the rest of the country. In the Republic of Port-au-Prince, we totally ignore what is happening elsewhere. In fact, we called the countryside the outside country. And to us at Radio Haiti, covering that part of it, going for me to go to the newsroom and tell my reporters, I need a cover story in the next 2 days or 3 days. I need a cover story on the countryside. What is happening in Jacmel? What is happening in the Artibonite Valley? What is happening in Marmelade? You know? And this, I think, is essential. And that part of our coverage, I think, remain probably the most important thing we have done.
Radio Haiti is now closed. Can you tell us about the events that led to its final closure?
Oh, well, it was closed several times, but I have to say that I think in 2000 we had, of course, the drama of Jean's assassination on April 3rd, 2000. And after Jean was killed, I got together with the team at the station and we all voted that we would continue. In fact, one of the reporters said, after a long silence, one of them said, Michel, you're the captain of the team. If you could cross that courtyard where the body of Jean was less than a month ago, and you say you are going to reopen the station, we are with you. And thanks to them, we reopened the station. But it was also always very fragile. As the investigation on Jean's assassination was going on, as we were making public whatever could be made public about the investigation, it became more and more dangerous for us. And Christmas, every day I would open the newscast that I used to anchor with Jean in the morning, and I would say, as I used to, I said, bonjour, Jean. Of course, there was no one to say bonjour, Michel, back. But I would say it has been so many days since we have been demanding justice. It went on and on and on until it happened Christmas Day, 2002. I was coming home, and as I was entering the courtyard with my car, I was driving. My bodyguard went down. He had seen two men with guns coming towards us. And he actually asked that the gate be closed behind him. And he was in the street, and they started shooting at the house. He was killed. And after Maxime Saïd was killed, a young man who had his whole life ahead of him. And after meeting with my newsroom and finding out that they had been receiving a number of threats, I decided to close Radio Haiti. And I did it in February 2003. I did an editorial denouncing the fact so many blockages in my husband's in the investigation into my husband's assassination. And I closed the station. And that was it. I came to the U.S. right after that.
Is there any project like it now in Haiti?
There are some stations, some of them where our former reporters are working, that are trying to, you know, to do a lot of what we used to do. Of course, the emphasis on the countryside is not there. The emphasis on investigative reporting, which we had, is not there. In most cases, but we have two or three stations that are really trying to push, you know, to open the news and to really keep alive our freedom of the press. It was won in blood.
Lorraine Dubois, how do you see the archive project going forward in the future?
Well, again, we're hoping as the library is able to digitize these materials, which is a very large project, to begin to continue to make these available with Laura's help. So the site will be there, and in a sense, we're trying to make it so that the station, which was so important, continues to live on and be on the air.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Lorraine Dubois is a professor of romance studies and history, the founder of the Forum for Scholars and Publics at Duke. Thanks, Lorraine.
Thank you.
Laura Wagner is an anthropologist and a writer. She's been working on this project for the past year. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
And Michelle Montaz is a former co-anchor at Radio Haiti. She joined us from New York. Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
There's more of the State of Things just ahead. Stay tuned.